Welcome to the second episode of the Ikivi podcast season 2. In this episode, we have with us Karuna Izara Parekh, a writer and ex-television anchor widely known for her activism, particularly regarding women's rights, communal harmony in the country, and most passionately, climate change and the environment. In 2015, she co-founded the sustainable company, The Burlap People in Calcutta. She is the author of 2 books, the best-selling novel The Heart Asks Pleasure First, and a collection of poems where stories gather. In this episode, we speak with her about her journey, the impact she wants to create with her work, and her views on how social media holds power in today's time. We also talk about the conscious values she practices and how they reflect in her work and personal style. I'm so excited about this conversation because I want to kind of understand, like we've been, you know, in touch several times, but like I've also been following you and you've been in our minds, right, for so long that I know you only from your social media. And I'm actually just going to dive right into this because this is how I want our conversation to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dive right into it.
Yeah. But my question is, so before any of that, I know you from your social media, right? And I have, obviously you assume certain things about a person or whatever it is, like consciously, subconsciously. So I wanted this conversation to be more about understanding you as a person and your thoughts, as opposed to not so much about the work that you do or anything of that sort, but like what led you to where you are today and what makes you who you are. So my first question to you, thank you so much, Karuna, for joining us today and having this conversation. I'm excited. So my first question is about the many things that you do. You know, whether it's work or personally, you are many things and you do many things. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Goodness, that's a big question you've started with. So it's interesting you say that you've known me mostly through my social media, because I think that is how most people have known me, especially in recent years when social media has sort of taken over our lives. But I have, in fact, started this year thinking a lot about who I am on social media and what parts of myself I show. And I think each of us shows a very curated self, you know, however authentic we try to be, each of us shows some curated version of ourselves on social media platforms. And I've been questioning of late what I show and why I don't show more of myself, my real self, and why I choose to show the things I do and who am I really. So I've been asking myself these questions as well. And I've been trying to engage more with social media in a very healthy way. And for the past few years, the way I thought it was healthy to engage with social media was to simply not, you know, to just cut off from it. And this year I started with a slightly different energy where I thought, I actually really enjoy this audience that, the people who follow me are just wonderful. You know, they're mostly women. They're people who think a lot like me. They're people who are really interested in the environment, who teach me new things about the planet, about saving the planet, about fashion and my choices. They're big readers. So it's all people I actually really love interacting with. And I had cut myself off from that for a long time. So I'm renegotiating that space right now. And so this is a very big part of where I am, like, who am I and what do I want to show? So to sort of answer your question, my journey has been really varied, right? I studied journalism and I came back from the UK where I was studying. I studied in Wales. I came back and I had all these dreams of writing books and being a journalist. And after a while, I did that. I worked with a bunch of NGOs. And then I sort of got this phone call to be on television. And I ended up becoming a TV anchor just by saying yes, very whimsically, to this job that took me around the world hosting a travel show. And it was my first experience of fame or popularity. And I wasn't sure what I felt about that. I was really young and I wasn't sure what I felt about this. And I didn't have the tools to negotiate that space. Thankfully, it was a pre-social media time of our lives. We just had Facebook and that was mostly friends. So I was spared like a sort of Instagram audience or the sense of adulation to a great extent. But it was still something to grapple with. And, you know, I spent many years then dealing with that, stepping into the modeling world. And it took some time for me to sort of find myself again and to ground myself and ask myself, what is it you really want to do or wanted to do? And that's when I came back to my writing, which is the most core part of me, I think. And I ended up publishing my books, you know, because I really sat down and gave time to that craft. So the journey has been very varied. This is, of course, like the few sentence version of it. But yeah, I've done all these different things. And very often, I think I've done them just because I said yes to many things, you know. Mm-hmm. I just said yes. Like, and I to some extent, I don't know maybe if you feel this way, but I think your 20s are good for that, right? Yeah. Like, I think we were also a generation that fell in this gap time of, you know, the generation just before us were very focused on like doing one thing. Mm-hmm. And the generation after us, I find like the Gen Zers, you know, I find that they are very focused as well, but, you know, in a way where they really follow that one passion, you know, and they know that they can follow anything that they choose to. But I think we were kind of in the middle, and that gave us, though, you know, it was a generation that felt a bit flighty at times, I think. I think the silver lining of it is that we got to try a lot of things. And I spent my 20s trying a lot of things, which I really think is was a privilege, right?
Yeah. You've done all of these things. So in today's world, today, who are you?
I identify myself as a writer, which takes some time, I think, to do, because I think you tend to say I write, but you don't call yourself a writer or a poet, you know.
Why is that?
I think it feels silly, that's why. And that's so sad, isn't it? Mm. But I think there's a self-consciousness that comes with saying those things. And I'm getting used to saying them now, but I identify as a writer, who is someone who writes, essentially, and we can keep it to just that, which is a comfortable definition, you know. And I encourage a lot of young writers to identify themselves as a writer early on and not when they get published, which is like, you know, that's like a death wish, because sometimes you're never going to be published, perhaps, you know, but that doesn't make you any less of a writer. Your success is not dependent on what other people view you as, you know. I think it's very much the act of writing that makes you a writer. So I identify myself as a writer today when it comes to, you know, a task that I do, but I also identify as an activist. You know, I also identify as someone who works in the fashion industry, who tries to negotiate the ethics of that industry. I also think of myself as many other things, you know, like I'm a dog mom. There you go. You know, I'm someone who used to live in Delhi and now lives in Calcutta and has adopted this city wholeheartedly, you know. So I think there's many things that make up who I am today.
Yeah, for sure. And to what you said about being a writer, I think, again, we're in that middle generation where the previous generation was probably self-conscious about calling themselves things until they achieve, quote unquote, something or like get their book published. Yeah. Whereas the next generation, the Gen Zers, are the ones that are like, can have the confidence to call themselves a lot of things, you know? So I think we're in that middle where we're trying to figure out what our balance is.
For sure. And I think there's, you know, just to play devil's advocate, though I'm very happy for the confidence of young people, I do sometimes think that there is a lack of doing the work. You know, there's a lot of calling yourself certain things, but there is a bit of a lack of doing the work and a lack of persistence with it. You know, I think that a lot of this social media, this generation that has grown up with social media, you know, they've also grown up with the adulation that I spoke of earlier, the adulation that I didn't experience, you know, thanks to the lack of this media being around at that time. You can build an audience, you know, so easily. You can buy followers. You can, and there's a danger to that as well. So yeah, that's the flip side of that side.
Yeah. What do you feel that adulation that we have with social media and, you know, how do you feel that's going to affect us both positively and negatively as a society? The reason I say positively is because as we're trying to create a lot of movements in different industries and trying to make change, there is that positive angle to it where people have a voice and people can gather a lot of people to think a certain way. But there's also a flip side to it. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and the flip side, I mean, it's so dangerous, right? Because we've seen what like online troll bhakt army sort of what they can do, you know, that kind of attack is, it's so dangerous. More recently, you know, we've seen what someone like Andrew Tate can do and how poisonous that narrative is, especially when it spreads, especially to young people who are so vulnerable when it comes to this kind of thought. You know, they absorb it so easily and they're convinced so easily. So I think the dangerous side of it is very, very dangerous. And we're talking on a much bigger scale than the work that you and I do. But I like to also focus on the positives, you know, especially with the pandemic. You know, for example, it became a great space for connection. And I loved seeing that. I loved seeing the kind of art people were putting out, especially for those who spent the pandemic alone. And I mean, even for, say, journalists in that time, you know, to just be able to put out the truth, citizen journalism, it's a wonderful thing to see. But yeah, I think that there's the good and the bad. And I think that I personally try to continue to focus on the positives and on using this space for positive, because it is to our advantage that we can use it if we, and that's why I've been questioning my departure from social media a little bit in the last few years. And I came back with a bit of renewed energy and thought, you know, to just throw your hands up and say, I don't want to be part of this. It's very toxic. You know, that's also a convenient way. And yes, we should take our breaks from it, but it is convenient to say that. And it is a bit defeatist. Instead, I think it's better maybe to say, how can I use this for good? And to, you know, continue to find the good in it as well. But it's difficult. I mean, how about you? Like, I know that, you know, with IKIVI, like what you've created, it's so special. You know, it's something for me beforehand, like before, I didn't used to be able to go to one platform to find, say, greener choices when it came to consumerism, right? Which is such a tricky thing anyway. You know, people like us, I think we have spent so much time preaching about this and then trying to live our lives by these rules, you know, that benefit the planet and all that. And then, you know, and then you wonder like, oh, like, how do I want to live my life like this, but where are the tools to help me? So, you know, when I would, for example, try and shop, I wouldn't be able to find that one space. And I have to say, IKIVI really did fill that gap for me in a way, which was wonderful. But at the same time, I'm sure you find bad news, say, when it comes to climate change, every single day online. So how do you, like, personally keep your spirits up or find hope while putting, you know, this out there? Like, I think when you expose yourself to the good of anything, you're immediately exposed to the bad of it as well, right? So,
yeah, I think that's a It's a very difficult thing to find that balance, because even as a business, right, you're battling with the algorithms that are out there and so on the one hand, we're trying to create awareness about what sustainable fashion is, because there still is a large share of people that just don't understand what it means and what is going on behind the scenes. So it is something that we're really trying heavily to do. But at the same time, we get such limited time and people's attention that we also have to sell product. We also have to kind of keep ourselves going, right? So it's a really, really difficult balance to achieve, because we do want to share news and we want to share what is going on in the world so that people can make more conscious choices. But at the same time, that's extremely, extremely difficult with what is out there.
Yeah, sometimes I do find it tips to being so negative that instead of making people move towards a better choice, it makes them just throw their hands up and say, well, if this is the state of things, what's the point?
Yeah.
We're careening towards, the end. So I might as well, live it up while I can. And that doesn't work either. It's such a fragile balance, at burlap people, we do have found where we become slaves to the algorithm. And very often there's so much frustration because you've built this business so carefully and it is a greener version of any other kind of business doing the same. And the sad thing is that even the people who follow you and really want to see your products and are invested in your story often don't get to know what's going on with you because you're essentially blocked from view.
Exactly.
And we often have this conversation at the Burlap People headquarters where we're like, how do we be seen more? How do we connect more? And we've become so dependent on these few very sort of toxic little platforms to carry our message out there. So,
thank you for listening to the Ikivi podcast. If you enjoy listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikivi.com. That is IKKIVI.com. We are a small sustainable business based in India, run by 5 women, handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode. That kind of leads me actually to my next question, or rather two questions. One is if you're okay with sharing with us what your intentions are with the platform currently, like with Instagram, for example, and how you, because I know exactly what you mean by kind of figuring out who you want to show online, right? Like we constantly have that battle back and forth as we evolve, as we grow older and things like that. So that's one of my questions. And the other question is how, and you also called yourself an activist. So how do people make a change or create awareness or bring about thought when at the same time not being kind of imposing about anything and actually making that change and actually getting people to think a certain way? Because a lot of times we see people kind of yelling at us, right? Like saying we're not doing this, which I feel prevents us. And I've felt that as well. Like we're talking so much about sustainable fashion and ethical fashion that we're not acknowledging. Like for me, for example, I have found it difficult to buy sustainable clothing for my daughter who's 8 months old. Like I needed basic onesies. It's difficult to find. And quite honestly, the H&M quality of onesies are great and they last forever because they kind of stretch out and things like that. But if I were to put something like this online as the founder of a sustainable fashion business, I would get so much backlash for it that I would never talk about it. But it is part of progress, right? Like I'm still looking for sustainable options that I can within my own means. But I see this a lot more, and people are not acknowledging that there is no perfect way to do things. Like, this is it.
With sustainability and, you know, the online has been long and has been complicated. So, you know, when I started talking about this stuff online, I immediately gained like a lot of followers who were very interested in this. And I was very vocal about, you know, shopping less, about buying better, about workers' rights, about what it is that we actually call organic or vegan. And, you know, and I spoke about this stuff a lot over the years. And what happened is that I think people began to see me as some sort of voice or icon for this. And I think what they forget is that I'm just a human being trying to do my best. I don't really know better than the next person who's passionate about this. I just have a platform where I speak about it. And because I have an audience that's engaged, I feel it's almost my duty to talk about these things. You know, and what happened is that if I was ever seen, say, in a Zara, or if I was ever, you know, seen wearing something that wasn't, say, 100%, you know, organic, vegan, fair trade, etc., I was immediately thought of as a failure, or worse, a traitor to this movement. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, as I said, I'm only human. So my genes are Zara genes. I would love to be able to find a pair of jeans in India that's, you know, maybe not those, maybe. And very often we just didn't have the option. I think we have more and more options each year. But when I started talking about this, which isn't even that long ago, I want to say maybe 5 to 7 years ago, there were less options. And I'm sure you'll agree with me on that.
Yeah.
You know, it's people like you who have actually given brands like this a platform to have the space to explore these things and explore creating more and creating locally and things like that. So, you know, when I faced like a lot of toxic backlash, I, of course, wanted to learn from it. And I took the feedback. And the best thing you can do with that kind of criticism is actually go back into your shell a little and think about it and don't shut down. I think as much as it hurts to be called out on things, to actually examine it and say, right, what can I do better? And maybe they're right. Maybe my genes could have been secondhand Zara. You know, maybe I could have waited. Maybe, you know, so I think there's ways of taking the feedback and making the most of it. But very often it just felt very bitter and it felt very nasty. And as a result, I quietened down and I stopped talking about these things so vocally because I thought, hey, you know, I'm living my life and clearly the rest of you here who I'm talking to seem to know better. So cool, you guys do it, right? So I stopped talking about it so much. And I have to say, even on a personal level, I sometimes set targets for myself that were, you know, really unachievable at points. Like I did 1 year of absolutely no shopping and I charted it online and it was great. And I asked other people to do it with me. It was part of Fashion Revolution's campaign that year. And I said, okay, I'm going to go 1 year and I'm not going to buy a single thing. And for the most part, I think I did succeed. I think I bought like something like a pair of panties or something that year. You know, it was really like very good.
That's amazing.
But thank you. But I mean, to be honest, when I said this, I had so many people write to me, Nivi, and say, hey, I've done this for 3 years. I've already done this for 5 years. And I was so impressed by them. And it was wonderful to see, you know.
Yeah.
I have no illusions about wanting to be the best at this. The more of us doing it or even getting there halfway, the better for the planet. Right? So it's not about me winning anything. It's just about like, you know, a community sharing these ideas and maybe putting this thought into someone's head who hasn't had that thought before, right? So, yeah, so I did this challenge and it was great. But right after that, you know, the pandemic started and I remember feeling the frustration of being stuck at home and having just finished this year. And I remember when online shopping opened up, I think I bought more in that year than I'd bought in the previous 3 years, you know. So it kind of failed as well. And, you know, I've been negotiating like how I can find something that works, that's doable for me. And I haven't put this on social media yet because, as I said, I'm sometimes a little scared to share these thoughts on social media because, you know, there's people who hold you to them. There's a lot of like comparing. There's a lot of backlash and sometimes even nastiness. But one of the things that really struck me that was very beautiful is Riya Gupte, who used to work with you for a long time and I think helped develop like the Kiwi visual language for a long time. She had shared that she tries to buy 12 things in a year, you know, 12 new things in a year. And I thought that's a very doable, nice way of looking at it. So that's something I'm examining this year and saying, well, why don't I set a target? And, you know, I set a target for my book reading, you know, for my books. I'm like, okay, I'm going to read 50 books this year. That's one a week. That's doable. So I thought maybe in the same way, I should set this target of like one thing a month that you absolutely love. And I think there's great wisdom in that because you're sort of saving up to buy that one precious thing. You can make sure it's something you really want. You know, you can make sure it's something that's special to you. You know, it's not a whimsical buy. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about it beforehand. And perhaps that'll work for me. But like I said, I'm not sure about sharing that on social media just yet. Because it feels a little scary. On the flip side, when you say, how are you going to use social media? One of the ways I use it is to learn more about this as well, right? Is to learn more about greener practices and expose myself to really cool accounts that talk about this stuff. So that's one of the things. It's not always, I think, about what I'm going to put out on it. It's so much about what I'm going to take from it as well. And I love that.
Yeah,
I love it as a spin-off. Yeah, and you know, there's such cool things we learn about. Like suddenly you'll see an article about like I don't know mushrooms that eat plastic. You know, suddenly you'll see an article about like some activism project succeeding in blocking some kind of construction, and you're just like, this is brilliant. So I think we can also use it to take from it and to take joy from it.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, with most things in life, I guess, is what you end up taking from things as opposed to, you know, just taking everything and getting overwhelmed with it all. My next question to you is, what does conscious living mean to you?
Oh, well, there's many. There are so many different layers. That's a great question, actually. So, you know, initially, I thought of conscious living as just greener living, right? Where you're very aware of what you're buying, you're very aware of how much you're using, you're aware of your carbon footprint constantly. And I thought of it as the big things. You know, you are, say, carrying a cloth bag with you when you go out. You are trying to compost your food. You are trying to buy more local products, you know, and produce. But I think over time, you know, this idea of what it is to live consciously has really expanded for me. And I think of it more in terms of, I mean, it's almost spiritual what I feel about conscious living now, you know. It feels like a deep connection to the planet, but also to other people and mostly to myself, you know. So I think that's where my conscious living is moving nowadays. Of course, the core principles of a greener life and a more sustainable life exist. But I think I'm also looking at being present, you know, questioning things, doing things slowly and with more love. And I think that when you are living consciously, it slows things down and it gives you more space to make choices that are better, both for yourself and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just about, like, for example, when you're going grocery shopping. I think when you go grocery shopping unconsciously, you know, you're just in there, you go in there when you're hungry, you start picking things off a shelf, whatever looks attractive, you're just popping it in, you know, your cart or your basket or whatever, and you check out and you come home and you have like a ton of things you don't need, you've spent money you don't have, you've got a ton of junk food, for example, you haven't thought about what you're going to make with this. So for me, that is unconscious grocery shopping, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the most mundane sort of example. But here's my conscious grocery shopping. I make a list from before. I'm not just making a list. I'm thinking, what am I going to make with these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm thinking, right, instead of ordering this online, let me go to the market. Let me carry my cloth bag with me and go at a time when for me. You go there and you might interact with the people selling the vegetables. That interaction is very beautiful, right? That's an interaction that then is healthy. You are also surrounded by these vegetables and goods. You touch it, you feel it, it's tangible, it's gorgeous. You know, you understand where your food comes from. And then you buy only what you need. You know, you're buying it also from a place where the person who wants it, the person who's selling it actually needs the money. It's less capitalist. And then you come home and maybe you wash those things yourself. You know, maybe you decide what you're going to turn them into. And that whole experience, it might sound cheesy, you know, what I'm describing. It might sound impossible to people in this age of hustle, but that is conscious grocery shopping, isn't it? And I can't do that all the time. You know, I live a very busy life and I, most of all, I'm slave to the, you know, online order. But I think there's a compromise we can make. And I think there's ways of doing everything that makes it better. And that is conscious living for me now.
Yeah. And I think you said it so beautifully. The just describing that whole experience, like, makes you excited to go grocery shopping, you know, to buy those vegetables and actually cook a meal for yourself. Sometimes I really want people to have that experience and try and talk about these things a lot more, so that there's a lot more beauty that you can experience in life, you know, instead of just kind of living with your blinders on or your head down or whatever and kind of just going about.
Totally. And Nivi, you know, the way you put it was so nice when you said it makes you excited, right? And that's the thing, that of course, a conscious life, it's a life where it takes more effort. I mean, there's no two ways about it. To live consciously is more effort. And I am someone who's privileged enough to be able to make that effort, right? I know people who work ridiculously long hours who would laugh if they heard this version of shopping that I just described. You know, they'd be like, right, well, I'm going to get online and I'm going to order from my local store. And whenever it comes, I'm happy. And I'm going to toss whatever I can in the microwave, because that's how, you know, that's what suits my lifestyle. And, you know, that's fine and that's fair. And I do understand that having the space to make that choice is also a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
But all I'm saying is, it is a more joyous life. It is a slower life. It is a more joyous life. And maybe that's why it sounds exciting, right? Because
yeah,
when I describe it, and I think there's more pleasure in it as well, right?
Yeah, for sure. What is something that excites you when you wake up every day?
Wow, I have spent the last year fighting depression. After a long time, you know, I found myself in a bad mental health space over 2022. And I have to say, like, that question just like punched me in the gut, because I actually paused and I didn't have an answer.
That this kind of is hitting a lot of nerves.
It's good as well, right? It's important, I think, to go through those feelings. I do think that one of the things that really excites me and that I look forward to when I wake up is reading. And reading has gotten me through some of the worst parts of my life. And it's something that it allows me to escape. It allows me to imagine creation. Since I'm a writer, reading is, it gives me new ideas. It's always inspirational. So I think I would say reading is really one of the things I look forward to. I live near a very big park in Calcutta. There's a man-made lake, which is massive, and it's a 190-acre park. And one of the things my husband and I did during the pandemic was actually shift homes to this new home near this park, because I realized I really needed to be near greenery more. And this is walking distance for me. And so one of the things that say that excites me apart from reading is spending time with nature. And, you know, I love looking out at the trees and finding a bird on a branch that I've never seen before. I love in the monsoon when I find like mushrooms on the tree trunks. I love when I'm walking by the lakes and like these little ducks come up. So I think those are two things that both excite and soothe me.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you have coming up for 2023? And what is something that you can give us kind of a sneak peek into?
Well, I'm writing, and I'm not able to say yet what I'm writing, but I'm writing something. So there's that. And that is something that excites me, actually. So there is a new project I'm working on, and I'm not announcing it yet, but there is something. So that's one of the things I'm doing. Yeah.
You know, that question actually could have a nice way to wrap up this conversation, but I'm going to ask you one more question because I'm curious to know. With all creative professionals in general, there is a process that they follow. What is your creative process like? And it's never linear, of course, like it's all over the place, but how do you go about writing, and what does that look like?
So, you know, it's funny, if you'd asked me this question, say 2 years ago, when my novel had just come out, I actually probably wouldn't have an answer, because I myself have only recently started viewing or witnessing my creative journey from an outside perspective. And I'm now able to understand what my process is. I really had no idea before. It felt so haphazard to me. And I think maybe it feels like that to a lot of people. They don't know how they're going about it, but it's somehow coming together. And that's how creative work often is, right? But after these years, I have figured out what it is that I do. So, you know, there's this one school of thought which says you need to write every single day. Like, you know, if you're doing some creative work, you have to do it every single day. And that was never me. And it was something that really worried me, because I thought, am I lazy? Then I thought, oh, you know, I'm ungrateful. I thought that I even confused it for lack of passion at times. You know, I thought, oh, maybe I'm not as passionate about writing as I think I am. But I found that none of those things are true. You know, I'm extremely hardworking when I sit down to a project. You have to be, otherwise you're never going to get a book out. And I'm extremely passionate about writing. There's no question of it. It's what actually keeps me going. But I found that I'm just someone who waits. I don't necessarily write every day, but I think about writing every single day. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not conceptualizing a piece of writing or making notes for it in my head and or on paper. And I found that I wait and wait until I feel an idea is very ripe and ready. And that's when I come to it. And it's worked for me. I don't know if it's the correct way of doing things or doing creative work, but I find that creative work comes from this place where you know that if you now don't put it to paper, or if you don't commit it to physicality, that it is it is going to kill you. You know, you're absolutely going to burst from this. And that is the moment when I sit down to actually write. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's musicians who do that, who just wait until, you know, the tune is perfectly formed in their head and then commit it. And so I think it's all right to do that. And it has served me very well to not force my writing, you know, to wait for it, to respect it, to let an idea fully develop before I begin to work on it. And that's kind of my creative process. After I start, though, it's like fire, you know. I sit down and I do not stop till it's over. I remember when I was writing the Hard Ass Pleasure first, I would just be sitting at my, I would wake up in the morning, put my laptop onto the bed and immediately start writing. And I'd sit there and write all day. And Amitesh, my husband, he would come home from work and see me sitting there in the same place. And there'd just be like some burger wrapper or something next to me. And he was like, have you not gone out of bed all day? And I'm like, I've been sitting here like, yeah, hi. I've just been sitting here writing since the morning. And I just ordered some food in the middle. And there were many days where I forgot to eat even, you know, I'd just be so passionate about it. And then I'd sit him down and say, I need to read you what I wrote today. And I'd read out those few thousand words and he'd listen and give me feedback. And I'd often be like, then he'd say, oh, we need to go for dinner. And I'd be like, no, I can't go anywhere. I'm sitting right here till this is over. So yeah, that's kind of my process. And I'm trying to make it a healthier process for my next piece of
work. Yeah, I think you also very rightly said that, you know, you kind of question yourself sometimes thinking like, oh, is this the way it's supposed to be done? Or am I supposed to be doing it a different way? Like if you're, for example, if I'm trying to solve some issue at work, right? Like I'll be like, oh, maybe I should do it in this process and then it'll come out better. Or like I'll be able to solve that problem. But actually deep down inside, it's what's inside and what's telling you and your intuition a lot of times that kind of actually is the key as opposed to what you should be doing, right? Oh, it's a constant battle.
Yeah. And coming back to what we were talking about earlier, I think this is also part of living consciously, right? It's like listening to yourself and listening to your gut and doing the work, but doing it more intuitively.
Yeah. That kind of very beautifully leads me to my last question, which is with so much at stake and with the urgency for us as individuals to be taking more conscious steps in whatever area of life, not just in fashion, but in the way we live our lives every day. What, according to you, are some simple steps that people can take that are not so overwhelming, but something that still will make a difference? Because a lot of times we get overwhelmed with the problem, but there are a lot of simple, small things we can all do as individuals that can make a huge difference. What, according to you, are those few steps?
So, you know, Nivi, we all know what the easiest steps are, right? We were just talking about them earlier in this conversation. You know, you can say, oh, I think you should, you know, carry a cloth bag wherever you go. I think you should limit your shopping. Maybe you can switch to a menstrual cup if you're somebody who menstruates. I think you can compost your kitchen waste. You know, you can choose not to have plastic in your house. So I think those are the things we all know at this point, you know, from the plastic straw all the way to, you know, whatever it is. Like we know this list, right? I think these lists have been circulated now online as well quite a bit. And we always look for the greener option, right? But I will say this, two things. One, when it comes to fashion, I really, really want to request anyone listening in to actually read between the lines. You know, this is a problem I find I encounter a lot still where, you know, it's very hip for brands to call themselves green or eco-friendly. But what does that actually mean? You know, you can't just say it. And I think a lot of people while shopping, they just see that label and they're very soothed by it. You know, they're like, huh, okay, this is a greener company. But what actually makes it a greener company? You know, when we say vegan silk, what is vegan silk? Is it a synthetic material? Are we questioning that? Sure, it didn't come from a silkworm and that's great. You're not exploiting the little worm. But, you know, does that mean that it's never, ever going to disintegrate on this planet? You know, what about vegan leather? Like, vegan leather is one of the things that most pisses me off, because I'm like, yeah, it's plastic. There's no two ways about it. It is plastic. At the Burlap people, it's such a big problem we face. You know, people are often like, oh, you know, I want vegan leather. So we offer a canvas replacement, but we often have to try and explain to people that, man, vegan leather is just plastic. We refuse to use it. It's just never going to disintegrate. That's not what the planet needs right now. You know, so there's a lot of like sort of blind decision making when it comes to fashion, and a lot of false soothing and greenwashing. And so I really want to encourage people to ask questions of it. You know, is it fair trade? You know, the question, who made my clothes? It's not just a tag. It's not just a cute sign that we hold up once a year. Honestly, if a brand is not willing to show you their workshop, if a brand is not willing to show you their karigars, and the kind of like, how are they sitting? Is it a room with natural light? Do they have a lunch break? Are they allowed phones? Are they allowed music? How much space do they have around them? Is there water provided? Are there fans? You know, those are all questions we should be asking. And I'm surprised that more people don't. Also, like when they say organic cotton, what does that mean? I mean, is cotton, we all know, like cotton, it might be biodegradable, but is it really a sustainable fabric? I mean, the amount of water usage with cotton is, it's devastating, right? We know that. So I just feel like, instead of being soothed by the label, ask questions if you really, really care. And that comes to my second thing about what you can do. And I feel you can continue the conversation, because we all know the little things, but we don't like to bring it up. So, for example, you go into an office and, you know, it's a day where you're really feeling hot. You haven't carried your water bottle, and you sit down and someone in this office just hands you a little plastic bottle of Bisleri, right? And you take it and you're like, oh God, they're using those bottles, but you just drink it, right? You're like, chalo, theek hai. What does it take for you to say, hey, could I just have a glass of water instead? Or, hey, you know, you shouldn't be using these, because we amongst ourselves already know this stuff. But we often hesitate to have the conversation or to continue the conversation with people who may not have thought of these things. Even when it comes to the menstrual cup, you know, a lot of my friends found it very weird to use it. And I am a person who's extremely private about these things. And it was very, very awkward for me to have these conversations about this. But I forced myself to have them. And I urged friends to actually use this. And I was like, you know, you don't understand the kind of plastic waste you are creating. Mm-hmm. And it's not a conversation that I wanted to have, but I think it was a conversation that was necessary. And I think that it's more than lists of things. I feel like it's about taking those lists and having a continued conversation, and not dropping the ball on that, so that we can actually have consistent change constantly.
I love that. I love that having a conversation as a tip, because it makes so much of a difference, because it gives people the opportunity to just think a little differently and question things. And I have seen that personally make a huge difference. So I absolutely love that advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been so lovely talking to you.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikibi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikibi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikibi.